Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony. Skippy John Jones by Judy Schachner. Published by Dutton's Children's Books in 2003. Every morning, Skippy John Jones woke up with the birds. And this did not please his mother at all. "Get yourself down here right now, Mr. Kitten Britches," ordered Mama Junebug Jones. "No self-respecting cat ever slept with a flock of birds," she scolded, "or ate worms, or flew, or did his laundry in Mrs. Doohickey's bird bath." The lecture went on and on as usual. "You've got to do some serious thinking before you leave this room, Mr. Fuzzy Pants," said his mother, "about just what it means to be a cat, not a bird, not a mouse, or a grouse, or a moose or a goose, not a rat or a bat. You need to think about just what it means to be a Siamese cat. And stay out of your closet," she added, closing the bedroom door. But once he was alone, Skippy John Jones began to bounce and bounce and bounce on his big boy bed. "Oh, I'm Skippy John Jones, and I bounce on my bed, and once or six times I land on my head." On his way down to earth, from a gigantic big bounce, Skippy John Jones shot past his bedroom mirror. "Holy guacamole!" exclaimed Skippy John Jones. "What was that?" So up he went again, and again it appeared in the mirror. Then, using his very best Spanish accent, he said, "My ears are too big for my head. My head is too big for my body. I'm not a Siamese cat. I am a Chihuahua." Back on land, Skippy John Jones climbed into his toy box and rifled through some of his old junk. After he put on his mask and sword and climbed onto his mouse, Skippy John Jones began to sing in a muy, muy soft voice. "My name is Skippito Frisquito, clap, clap. I fear not a single bandito, clap, clap. My manners are mellow, I'm sweet like the jello. I get the job done, yes indeedo, clap, clap." Back in the kitchen, Jujubee, Jezebel, and Jillyboo Jones were helping Mama Junebug Jones make lunch. "Can Skippy John come out of his room now?" asked Jujubee. "No," answered Mama Junebug Jones. "Mr. Fluffernutter is still thinking." In fact, Skippy John wasn't thinking about being a Siamese cat at all. With a walk into his closet, his thoughts took him down a lonesome desert road far, far away in old Mexico. Not long into his journey, a misterioso band of chihuahuas appeared out of the dust. "Ay, caramba, who goes there?" asked Skippy John Jones.
"We go by the name of Los Chimichangos," growled Don Diego, the biggest of the small ones. "Who are you?"
"I am El Skippito, the great sword fighter," said Skippy John Jones.
Then the smallest of the small ones spoke up.
"Why, the mosquito, dude?" asked Poquito Tito.
"I go incognito," said Skippito.
"Do you like rice and beans?" asked Pintolito.
"Si, I love mice and beans," said Skippito.
"He might be the dog of our dreams," whispered Rosalita.
"Perhaps," said Tia Mia, "if he knows the secret password."
Leaning toward Don Diego, El Skipito half sneezed, half spoke the secret password into the Chihuahua's very large ear.
Ah, Chupichu!
Bless you, said Don Diego.
Gracias, said Skipito.
Then it is true, decreed Don Diego.
Yep, yippee, yippito. It's the end of Alfredo Bezito. Skipito is here. We've nothing to fear. Adios to the Bambambolito.
Then all the chimichangos went crazy loco. First, they had a fiesta. Then they took a siesta. But after waking up, the chimichangos got down to serious business. Using his paw, Don Diego drew a picture in the sand of the great Bambolito for Skipito to see. A great hush grew over the chimichangos, so great that one could hear a whisker drop.
Alfredo Bezito, whispered the crowd. El blimpo Bambolito bandito.
Si, said Poquito Tito. The bandito steals our frijoles.
Not your beans, cried Skipito, outraged.
Si, Poquito continued.
Red beans, black beans, Boston baked and blue, cocoa, coffee, kidney beans, pinto and jelly too. And now he comes for us, Poquito added.
Por qué? Asked Skipito.
Because we are full of the beans, too.
Then Don Diego stood tall and in his most somber voice declared,
Yo quiero frijoles.
Huh?
Asked Skipito.
The dude just wants his beans back, said Poquito Tito.
And you are the dog for the job.
Me?
Asked Skipito. Then all of the chimichangos turned toward Skipito, the great sword fighter. But poor Skipito had no time for a plan, because in the blink of an eye, a gigantic shadow darkened the landscape. The chimichangos scattered in all directions.
Vamos, Skipito! Or it is you, the bandito, will eat-o,
they cried. Skipito stood his ground, but his legs shimmied and shook like the jello, and his teeth chattered like the castanets. Then, in a muy, muy soft voice, he said,
My name is Skipito Frisquito. I fear not a single bandito.
But Alfred Bezito flew straight for Skipito until the bean-eating bandito hovered only inches away from the great sword fighter's face.
Holy frijoles!
Cried Skipito as he thrust his sword in the air. Suddenly, pop! Went the bandito, landing on Skipito's sword. And quicker than one could say, Chihuahua cheese and crackers. Every kind of bean came spilling out of Alfredo Bezito, the Bambolito bandito.
Yip, yippee, yippito. Our hero is El Skipito. He's the dog of our dreams who delivered the beans, and now we can make our burritos.
But back at home, there was such a ruckus coming from Skippy John's room that Mama Junebug Jones and the girls just had to find out what was going on. They raced down the hall to the kitty boy's room.
Bangito! Crashito! Papito! Skipito!
Just in time to see Skippy John's closet exploding. Then out flew Candy, beanbag doggies, and the kitty boy with his birthday pinata on his head.
Skippy John Jones, everyone cried.
Hola, muchachitas, he said in a muy, muy soft voice.
Mama Junebug Jones lifted up Skippy John and covered his head with furry, purry kisses.
"What am I going to do with you, Mr. Cocoa Pugs?" she scolded. That night, when he was supposed to be going to sleep, Skippy John began to bounce and bounce on his big boy bed. "Oh, I'm Skippy John Jones with a mind of my own, and I'll bounce on my bed for hours. I know that I'm a cat, but forget about that." "Say goodnight, Skippy John Jones," called his mother. "Buenas noches, mis amigos," said Skippy John Jones. The end. Skippy John Jones was read and sung a little bit by Michelle Dragony.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Crows of Pear Blossom by Aldous Huxley, illustrated by Barbara Cooney. For Olivia from Aldous. Christmas, 1944. Once upon a time, there were two crows who had a nest in a cottonwood tree at Pear Blossom. In a hole at the bottom of the tree lived a rattlesnake. He was very old and very big, and when he shook his rattles, the noise was so loud that it could be heard by the children at school in Little Rock. Most of the time, he slept, but every afternoon, punctually at 3:30, he used to crawl out of his hole, climb the tree, and look into the crow's nest. If there was an egg in the nest, which there generally was, he would swallow it at one mouthful, shell and all. Then he crawled back into his hole and went to sleep again. When Mrs. Crow came back from the store where she went every afternoon to buy her groceries, she would find the nest empty. "What could have happened to my darling little egg?" she would say as she hunted high and low, but she never found it. So after tea, she laid another one. This had gone on for a long time when, one day, Mrs. Crow came home earlier than usual and caught Mr. Snake in the act of swallowing her latest egg. "Monster," she cried, "what are you doing?" Speaking with his mouth full, the snake answered, "I'm having breakfast," and he glided down the tree and into his hole. When Mr. Crow came home that evening from Palmdale, where he worked as assistant manager in the drugstore, he found his wife looking very pale and haggard, pacing up and down the branch outside their nest. "What's the matter, Amelia?" he said. "You look quite ill. You haven't been overeating again, have you?" "How can you be so coarse and unfeeling?" Mrs. Crow burst out. "Here am I, working myself to the bone for you, when I'm not working, laying a fresh egg every single day, except Sundays, of course, and public holidays. 297 eggs a year, and not a single chick hatched out. And all you can do is ask if I've been overeating. And when I think of that dreadful snake, I go all of a tremble." "Snake?" said Mr. Crow. "What snake?" "The one that ate all my darling little eggs," said Mrs. Crow, and once again burst into tears. When at last she was able to explain what had happened, Mr. Crow shook his head. "This is serious," he said. "This is the sort of thing that somebody will have to do something about." "Why don't you go down into the snake's hole and kill him?" asked Mrs. Crow. "Somehow I don't feel that that's a very good idea," Mr. Crow answered. "Abraham, you're scared," said Mrs. Crow. "Scared?" repeated Mr. Crow. "I never said I was scared. All I said was that I didn't think your idea was a very good one. Your ideas are seldom good, I may add. That's why I shall go and talk to my friend Owl. Owl's a thinker. His ideas are always good." So he flew off to the tall poplar in Mr. Yost's garden, where Old Man Owl had his home. Old Man Owl, who worked on a night shift and slept all day, was just getting up when Mr. Crow knocked at the door. "Come in, Abraham," he said. "Excuse my being in bedroom slippers." Mr. Crow took a seat, and while Old Man Owl shaved and combed his feathers, he told him the whole story. "Well," said Old Man Owl when he had finished, "there's obviously only one thing to be done." "What's that?" "Wait and see." And with that, Old Man Owl opened the door and flew down into the middle of Mr. Yost's alfalfa patch, which had been irrigated that day and was still quite wet. "That's all muddy," said Mr. Crow as he landed beside his friend. Abraham, you talk too much, said Old Man Owl. Keep your beak shut and do exactly what I do. So saying, he took a big handful of mud and began to shape it into the form of an egg. Mr. Crow did the same, and when they had finished, Old Man Owl flew up to the roof of Olivia's house, just where the chimney came up from the living room. The stove was burning and the chimney was very hot. Old Man Owl dropped the two eggs into an old tin can and placed the can on top of the chimney. Then the two friends flew back to Owl's house and had supper. By the time they had finished washing up and listening to the evening concert on the radio, it was 10 o'clock and the moon was shining brightly over the mountains. I guess those eggs will be cooked by now, said Old Man Owl. So they flew back again to the chimney, and sure enough, the clay eggs had baked through and through and were as hard as stone. What color are your wife's eggs? Asked Old Man Owl. Pale green, said Mr. Crow, with a small black spots. Well, it's lucky that Siggy has been doing some painting around the place, said Old Man Owl. And, taking the can with the eggs, he flew down to the table outside the kitchen door where there were several pots of paints and some brushes. When the eggs had been painted so as to look exactly like real eggs, Old Man Owl and Mr. Crow dried them over the chimney. And then, about midnight, when the paint was quite hard, they flew back to the old cottonwood tree where Mrs. Crow was impatiently waiting for them. Well, she cried, which one of you has decided to go down the hole and kill the snake? Neither of us, said Mr. Crow. Neither of you, screamed Mrs. Crow. There must be 297 of my darling eggs disappear down that vile serpent's throat. Must my heart go on being broken day after day forever? Amelia, said Mr. Crow, you talk too much. Keep your beak shut and get out of your nest. Mrs. Crow did as she was told, and Old Man Owl took the eggs out of the can and placed them in the nest. What are those for? Asked Mrs. Crow. Wait and see, said Old Man Owl. And with that, he flew off towards Llano, where he had an appointment with a friend to go gopher hunting. Next afternoon, Mrs. Crow went down to the store as usual to do her shopping. While she was gone, Mr. Snake woke up and, feeling hungry, came gliding out of his hole, up the tree, and along the branch to Mr. and Mrs. Crow's nest. Two eggs today, he said. And he smacked his lips, for his mother neglected his education, and he had very bad manners. Then he stuck out his neck and swallowed the two eggs whole, first one and then the other. After that, he stretched himself along a branch in the sunshine and began to sing a little song. I cannot fly, I have no wings. I cannot run, I have no legs. But I can creep where the blackbird sings and eat her speckled eggs, ha ha, and eat her speckled eggs. Suddenly he broke off. Those eggs must have had very thick shells, he said to himself. Generally they break before they even get to my stomach, but this time it seems to be different. All at once he began to have the most frightful stomachache. Oh, he said, oh, oh, oh. But the stomachache only got worse and worse. Oh, owie, ooh. Mr. Snake began to writhe and wriggle and twist and turn, and he twisted and turned so much that without knowing what he was doing, he tied his neck in a running bowline knot around a branch and couldn't get loose again, but his tail was still free, and he went on lashing about with that. And he lashed so furiously he coiled and corkscrewed into such complicated convulsions that at last he got his tail tied up in a clove hitch around another branch of the tree. So there he was, and the harder he tried to get loose, the tighter the knot became. And all the time, the clay eggs in his insides were giving him the most excruciating stomach ache. By and by, Mrs. Crow came back from the store, and at first, when she saw the snake, she was frightened. But as soon as she noticed how tightly he had tied himself up, she felt very brave and proceeded to give the snake a very long lecture on the wickedness of eating other people's eggs. Since that time, Mrs. Crow has successfully hatched out 4 families of 17 children each, and she uses a snake as a little clothesline in which to hang the little crows' diapers. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Story of Ferdinand by Monroe Leaf. Drawings by Robert Lawson.
first published in 1936 for Viking Press. Once upon a time in Spain, there was a little bull, and his name was Ferdinand. All the other little bulls he lived with would run and jump and butt their heads together, but not Ferdinand. He liked to sit just quietly and smell the flowers. He had a favorite spot out in the pasture under a cork tree. It was his favorite tree, and he would sit in its shade all day and smell the flowers. Sometimes his mother, who was a cow, would worry about him. She was afraid he would be lonesome all by himself. "Why don't you run and play with the other little bulls and skip and butt your head?" she would say. But Ferdinand would shake his head. "I like it better here, where I can sit just quietly and smell the flowers." His mother saw that he was not lonesome, and because she was an understanding mother, even though she was a cow, she let him just sit there and be happy. As the years went by, Ferdinand grew and grew until he was very big and strong. All the other bulls who had grown up with him in the same pasture would fight each other all day. They would butt heads with each other and stick each other with their horns. What they wanted most of all was to be picked to fight at the bullfights in Madrid. But not Ferdinand. He still liked to sit just quietly under the cork tree and smell the flowers. One day, five men came in very funny hats to pick the biggest, fastest, roughest bull to fight in the bullfights in Madrid. All the other bulls ran around snorting and butting, leaping and jumping, so that the men would think that they were very, very strong and fierce and pick them. Ferdinand knew that they wouldn't pick him, and he didn't care. So he went out to his favorite cork tree to sit down. He didn't look where he was sitting, and instead of sitting on the nice cool grass in the shade, he sat on a bumblebee. Well, if you were a bumblebee and a bull sat on you, what would you do? You would sting him. And that is just what this bee did to Ferdinand. Wow, did it hurt! Ferdinand jumped up with a snort. He ran around puffing and snorting, butting and pawing the ground as if he were crazy. The five men saw him, and they all shouted with joy. Here was the largest and fiercest bull of all, just the one for the bullfights in Madrid. So they took him away for the bullfight day in a cart. What a day it was! Flags were flying, bands were playing, and all the lovely ladies had flowers in their hair. They had a parade into the bull ring. First came the bandilleros with long, sharp pins with ribbons on them to stick in the bull and make them mad. Next came the picadores, who rode skinny horses, and they had long spears to stick in the bull and make him madder. Then came the matador, the proudest of them all. He thought he was very handsome and bowed to the ladies. He had a red cape and a sword and was supposed to stick the bull last of all. Then came the bull, and you know who that was, don't you? Ferdinand. They called him Ferdinand the Fierce, and all of the bandilleros were afraid of him, and the picadores were afraid of him, and a matador was scared stiff. Ferdinand ran in the middle of the ring, and everyone shouted and clapped because they thought he was going to fight fiercely and butt and snort and stick his horns around. But not Ferdinand. When he got to the middle of the ring, he saw the flowers in all the lovely ladies' hair, and he just sat down quietly and smelled. He wouldn't fight and be fierce no matter what they did. He just sat and smelled. And the bandilleros were mad, and the picadores were mad, and the matador was so mad he cried because he couldn't show off with his cape and sword. And so they had to take Ferdinand home. And for all I know, he is sitting there still, under his favorite cork tree, smelling the flowers,
just quietly. He is very happy. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
Froggy Gets Dressed by Jonathan London, illustrated by Frank Remkowitz, published in 1992 by Viking Press. And I'm Chris Devsich. It was cold. Froggy woke up and looked out the window. "Snow! Snow!" he sang. "I want to play in the snow." "Go back to sleep, Froggy," said his mother. "Don't you know, frogs are supposed to sleep all winter. Wake up when the snow melts."
"No, no," cried Froggy. "I'm awake, awake. I want to go out and play in the snow."
So Froggy put on his socks, zoop, pulled on his boots, zup, put on his hat, zat, tied on his scarf, zwit, pulled on his mittens, zum, and flopped outside into the snow. Flop, flop.
"Froggy!"
called his mother.
"What?"
yelled Froggy. "Did you forget to put something on?" Froggy looked down.
"Oops!"
cried Froggy. "I forgot to put on my pants." He flopped back inside. Flop, flop, flop. Tugged off his mittens, untied his scarf, took off his hat, pulled off his boots, he left his socks on, and slipped his pants on, zip. Then he pulled on his boots, zup, put on his hat, zat, tied on his scarf, zwit, tugged on his mittens, zum, and flopped back outside into the snow. Flop, flop, flop.
"Froggy!"
called his mother.
"What?"
yelled Froggy. "Did you forget to put something on?" Froggy looked down.
"Oops,"
he cried. "I forgot to put on my shirt."
"And your coat,"
added his mother. He flopped back inside. Flop, flop, flop. Tucked off his mittens, untied his scarf, took off his hat. He left his pants, boots, and socks on, and buttoned up his shirt. Zut, zut, zut. Then he snapped on his coat, snap, put on his hat, zat, tied on his scarf, zwit, tugged on his mittens, zum, and flopped back outside into the snow. Flop, flop, flop.
"Froggy!"
called his mother.
"What?"
yelled Froggy. "Did you forget to put something on?" Froggy looked down. He had on his mittens, he had on his scarf, he had on his coat. He had on his shirt. He had on his pants. He had on his boots. He had on his socks. He reached up. Yep, he had on his hat. What could be missing?
"Your underwear!"
his mother laughed.
"Oops!"
cried Froggy, looking more red in the face than green. He flopped back into the house, flop, 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 tugged off his mittens, untied his scarf, unsnapped his coat, unbuttoned his shirt, unzipped his pants, pulled off his boots, took off his socks, he left his hat on, and slipped his long johns on with a zap of elastic. Then he put on one sock, zoop, pulled on one boot, zup, tugged on one mitten, zum, started to tug on the other and let it drop and said, "I'm too tired," and went back to sleep. Good night, Froggy.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
Velma Gratch and the Way Cool Butterfly. It's hard to be Velma, the littlest Gratch entering the first grade. That's because everyone has marvelous memories of her two older sisters, who are practically perfect first graders. Poor Velma. People barely remember her name, But all that changes on a class trip to the magnificent Butterfly Conservatory, a place neither of her sisters has ever been. When a monarch roosts on Velma's finger and won't budge for days, well, no one will forget Velma ever again. Alan Madison and Kevin Hawke celebrate everything butterfly, from migration to metamorphosis. A timid first grader undergoes a metamorphosis of her own into a confident scientist. Written by Alan Madison, illustrated by Kevin Hawks, published by Schwartz Wade Books, New York. Copyright 2007. Velma Gratch and the Way Cool Butterfly is read by Michelle Dragony. Velma Gratch was the youngest of the three Gratch sisters. Frida, the oldest, had gone through first grade first, followed by Fiona. Now it was Velma's turn. The chorus teacher remembered Frida best because she had a voice like an angel. The gym teacher remembered Fiona best because she ran like the devil. And the first grade teacher, Mr. Plexipus, fondly remembered both sisters because of Frida's miraculous math and Fiona's spectacular spelling. Everyone from the class guinea pig to the principal had magnificent memories of the older Gratch girls, but they could hardly even recall Velma's name. This made Velma feel as if she did not belong in the first grade at all. She wanted to curl up into a ball and roll right back into kindergarten. "Of course you belong," cooed Velma's mother, trying to cheer her up. "You've only just begun. Soon everybody will notice you." Velma couldn't wait. She needed to be noticed now. In chorus, she sang loudest so that the teacher could hear her best. In gym, she ran slowest so that the teacher could see her best. And in class, she refused to read and muddled her math. Mr. Plexipus lamented that she was the first Gratch sister ever sent to the principal's office. This brought a small smile to Velma's lips. "Littlest Gratch, why are you singing so loudly in chorus and running so slowly in gym?" inquired Principal crossly. "Because," answered Velma, "I wanted you to remember me just like you remember Frida and Fiona." The principal's owlish eyes opened wide. "But, my dear, those Gratches are remembered for good things." Velma's small smile pretzel twisted into a full-blown frown. Science was Velma's favorite subject. She had learned many fabulous facts, like how a rainbow is born and why a volcano burps. The latest lesson was about butterflies. Mr. Plexipus explained that a butterfly starts as an egg. The egg turns into a caterpillar. The caterpillar disappears into a chrysalis, which is like a little sack, and does not come out until it has changed into a beautiful butterfly. He called this changing metamorphosis. Velma didn't want to forget this extra long word, so she repeated it again and again as she walked home. Metamorphosis, metamorphosis, metamorphosis. "Frida, when you were in first grade, did you study butterflies?" Velma asked her older sister. "No, we learned worms," Frida replied. "Fiona, when you were in first grade, did you study butterflies?" Velma asked her middle sister. "No, we found out about frogs," Fiona stated. "Well," said Velma proudly, "we are studying butterflies and metamorphosis." "That's way cool," Frida declared, and Fiona bobbed her head in way cool agreement. Velma read everything in the library about butterflies. She discovered that there are 20,000 different kinds, which was a lot. She adored the ones with colorful names: brown elfin, frosted flasher, sleepy orange. And the ones with funny names, comma, question mark, American snout, not to mention the ones with strange names, morpho,
painted lady, gossamer wing. But her favorite butterfly of all was the orange and black monarch. When it got cold, all the monarchs would fly south to Mexico to stay warm. Velma thought this was an amazing coincidence because last winter vacation, she and her family had flown south to Mexico to stay warm too. In science, Mr. Plexipus announced that they would take a class trip to the Butterfly Conservatory, a place where real butterflies were collected and cared for. Because Velma didn't want to forget this extra long word, she repeated it again and again as she walked home. Conservatory, conservatory, conservatory. Frida, did you take a class trip in first grade? Velma asked her older sister. Absolutely. We went to the museum, Frida replied. Fiona, did you take a class trip in first grade? Velma asked her middle sister. Absolutely. We went to the aquarium, Fiona stated. Well, said Velma proudly, we're going to the Can-Can Serve the Story. That's way cool, Frida declared, and Fiona bobbed her head in way cool agreement. The Butterfly Conservatory was surrounded by fancy flower beds and bedecked with banners of butterflies. Velma was so excited, her knobby knees wobbled, her spaghetti arms trembled, and her carroty curls shook. A sharp-nosed woman holding a clipboard introduced herself. I am your tour guide. Inside, a butterfly might land on you, but please don't touch its wings. Does anybody know why? Velma's hand shot up. Because they're made out of teeny tiny scales that could rub off like dust, and that is not good, she explained. Precisely, said the guide. What is your name? I'm Velma, the youngest of the three Gratch sisters. I don't think I know your sisters, the guide commented as they entered the rainforest room. It was a magical space, slathered in tall trees and tangled vines. Water gurgled over rocks and butterflies of every variety, giant swallowtails, short-tailed skippers, pygmy blues, and best of all, monarchs flew up to forever. The guide explained that when it got cold in a couple of weeks, she would take the monarchs into the park and let them go free so that they could fly to Mexico. This traveling was called migration. Because Velma didn't want to forget this extra long word, she repeated it again and again as she walked through the rainforest. Migration, migration, migration. A gorgeous red comma rested on Randy's head. The class oohed. A baby brown elfin settled on Sandy's nose. The class awed. A big blue morpho alighted on Andy's shoulder. The class gasped, but not one single butterfly landed on any part of Velma. Time to leave, instructed Mr. Plexipus as they neared the exit. A tear formed in a distant corner of Velma's eye. All she wanted was one single tingly touch of a butterfly. On a nearby branch sat a most lovely monarch. How she yearned to pet those velvety wings. She moved slowly. The class was leaving. One more inch. It was so pretty. She froze. If she touched its wings, it might... Velma couldn't do it. She couldn't hurt a butterfly. Now come on, Velma. We have to go. Sadly, Velma turned away, and at that very moment, the most marvelous thing happened. The monarch hopped from its branch and roosted right on Velma's finger. Delicate wings slowly folding, antenna twitching. Weightless and wondrous, the insect sat. Velma was in heaven.
The bus is waiting, her teacher called.
Velma placed her finger next to the branch. Bye-bye, butterfly, she whispered. But the monarch didn't move.
We're closing, said the guide.
Velma lightly blew on the butterfly. It didn't budge.
Without ever touching the butterfly's wings, everyone tried to get the monarch to fly, crawl, or walk off Velma's finger, but nothing worked. At last, Velma was told to leave with the butterfly, still perched on her pointer. It stayed there on the bus ride home. It stayed there when she slept and was still there when she awoke. It stayed during gym, math, reading, ballet, soccer. Day in and day out, it stayed put on that pointer. Soon everyone, from the class guinea pig to the principal, knew about Velma and her butterfly. Mr. Plexipus lamented that Velma was positively the first Gratch ever sent to the principal's office twice. This stuck an oversized frown on Velma's face. "Velma," Principal crossly commanded, "it is time for the butterfly to go."
"Oh, I've tried to get it to go," Velma moaned, "but it just won't."
"Well, no one will ever forget this," the principal fumed. Velma's frown pretzel twisted into a small smile.
"Hey, I know what to do," she proclaimed. "Migration!"
Velma paraded Principal Crossley, Mr. Plexipus, her class, Frida, and Fiona to the park. Car horns honked, people yelled, but despite all the commotion, the monarch did not move. A cool wind from the west blew through the field. In the middle stood the tour guide from the conservatory, carefully opening an enormous sack. A single monarch butterfly stepped out, looked around, and flitted away. It was trailed by 10, then 10 more, soaring up and up until the sky overflowed with the thick clouds of orange and black.
"What's happening?" wondered Frida. "Why are you letting them go?" demanded Fiona.
"Migration," answered the guide.
"Migration," repeated Velma.
The wind tousled Velma's hair and tickled her butterfly's wings. The monarch jumped onto her nose as if to give her a kiss, and then took flight to join its friends. Over the treetops it flew, over the skyscrapers, and up into the wild blue, orange, and black yonder on its way to Mexico.
"Velma!"
shouted Principal Crossley, and every eye turned towards her.
"Oh, no," fretted Velma, sure that she was about to become the only Gratch ever sent to the principal's office 3 times.
"That was way cool," the principal said,
and one and all bobbed their heads in way cool agreement. Then, with her fine finger where the monarch had sat still a tingle, Velma, followed by her 2 sisters, floated home. The end. If you want to have a little fun, Google all the names of the butterflies and see what they look like.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Little Red Hen was read by Lorraine Cerullo. Thanks, Lorraine.
The Little Red Hen, a favorite folktale, pictures by J.P. Miller. Published in 1954 by Golden Books Publishing Company. One summer day, the Little Red Hen found a grain of wheat. "A grain of wheat," said the Little Red Hen to herself. "I will plant it." She asked the duck, "Will you help me plant this grain of wheat?" "Not I," said the duck. She asked the goose, "Will you help me plant this grain of wheat?"
"Not I," said the goose.
She asked the cat, "Will you help me plant this grain of wheat?"
"Not I," said the cat.
She asked the pig, "Will you help me plant this grain of wheat?"
"Not I," said the pig.
"Then I will plant it myself," said the Little Red Hen, and she did. Soon the wheat grew tall, and the Little Red Hen knew it was time to reap it. "Who will help me reap the wheat?" she asked.
"Not I," said the duck.
"Not I," said the goose.
"Not I," said the cat.
"Not I," said the pig.
"Then I'll reap it myself," said the Little Red Hen, and she did. She reaped the wheat, and it was ready to be taken to the mill and made into flour. "Who will help me carry the wheat to the mill?" she asked.
"Not I," said the duck.
"Not I," said the goose.
Not I, said the cat.
Not I, said the pig.
Then I'll carry it myself, said the little red hen, and she did. She carried the wheat to the mill, and the miller made it into flour. When she got home, she asked, Who will help me make the flour into dough? Not I, said the duck.
Not I, said the goose.
Not I, said the cat.
Not I, said the pig.
Then I will make the dough myself, said the little red hen, and she did. Soon the bread was ready to go into the oven. Who will help me bake the bread? Said the little red hen. Not I, said the duck.
Not I, said the goose.
Not I, said the cat.
Not I, said the pig.
Then I will bake it myself, said the little red hen, and she did. After the loaf had been taken from the oven, it was set on the windowsill to cool. And now, said the little red hen, who will help me eat the bread? I will, said the duck.
I will, said the goose.
I will, said the cat.
I will, said the pig.
No, I will eat it all myself, said the little red hen, and she did. And she went to bed with a happy tubby and a happy book. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
Where the Wild Things Are was written and illustrated by Maurice Sendak. It was published by HarperCollins in 1963. The knight wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind or another. His mother called to him, Wild Thing! And Max said, I'll eat you up! So he was sent to bed without eating anything. That very night, in Max's room, a forest grew and grew and grew until his ceiling was hung with vines and the walls became the world all around. And an ocean tumbled by with a private boat for Max, and he sailed off through the night and day and in and out of weeks and almost over a year to where the wild things are. And when he came to the place where the wild things are, they roared their terrible roars, and gnashed their terrible teeth, and rolled their terrible eyes, and showed their terrible claws. Till Max said, Be still! And he tamed them with the magic trick of staring into all their yellow eyes without blinking once, and they were frightened, and called him the most wild thing of all, and made him king of all the wild things. And now, cried Max, let the wild rumpus start. Imagine the rumpus. Now stop, said Max, and sent the wild things off to bed without their supper. And Max, the king of all wild things, was lonely and wanted to be where someone loved him best of all. Then, all around him, from far away across the world, he smelled good things to eat. So he gave up being king of where the wild things are. But the wild things cried, Oh, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so. And Max said, No. And the wild things roared their terrible roars and gnashed their terrible teeth and rolled their terrible eyes and showed their terrible claws. But Max stepped into his private boat and waved goodbye and sailed back over a year and in and out of weeks and through a day and into the night of his very own room, where he found his supper waiting for him, and it was still hot. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Tale of Peter Rabbit by Beatrix Potter. Published by Frederick Warren in 1902. Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits, and their names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. They lived with their mother in a sandbank underneath the root of a very big fir tree. Now, my dears, said old Mrs. Rabbit one morning,
You may go into the fields or down the lane, but don't go into Mr. McGregor's garden. Your father had an accident there. He was put in a pie by Mrs. McGregor. Now run along and don't get into mischief. I'm going out. Then old Mrs. Rabbit took a basket and her umbrella and went through the wood to the baker's. She bought a loaf of brown bread and 5 currant buns. Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, who were good little rabbits, went down the lane to gather blackberries. But Peter, who was very naughty, ran straight away to Mr. McGregor's garden and squeezed under the gate. First he ate some lettuces and some French beans, and then he ate some radishes. And then, feeling rather sick, he went to look for some parsley. But round the end of a cucumber frame, whom should he meet but Mr. McGregor. Mr. McGregor was on his hands and knees planting out young cabbages, but he jumped up and ran after Peter, waving a rake and calling out, "Stop, thief!" Peter was most dreadfully frightened. He rushed all over the garden, for he had forgotten the way back to the gate. He lost one of his shoes amongst the cabbages, and then the other shoe amongst the potatoes. After losing them, he ran on 4 legs and went faster, so that I think he might have got away altogether if he had not unfortunately run into a gooseberry net and got caught by the large buttons on his jacket. It was a blue jacket with brass buttons, quite new. Peter gave himself up for lost and shed big tears. But his sobs were overheard by some friendly sparrows, who flew to him in great excitement and implored him to exert himself. Mr. McGregor came up with a sieve, which he intended to pop upon the top of Peter, but Peter wriggled out just in time, leaving his jacket behind him, and rushed into the tool shed and jumped into a can. It would have been a beautiful thing to hide in if it had not had so much water in it. Mr. McGregor was quite sure that Peter was somewhere in the tool shed, perhaps hidden underneath a flower pot. He began to turn them over carefully, looking under each. Presently, Peter sneezed. Kerchoo! Mr. McGregor was after him in no time, and tried to put his foot upon Peter, who jumped out of a window, upsetting 3 plants. The window was too small for Mr. McGregor, and he was tired of running after Peter anyway. He went back to his work. Peter sat down to rest. He was out of breath and trembling with fright. He had not the least idea which way to go. Also, he was very damp with sitting in that can. After a time, he began to wander about, going lippity-lip, lippity-lip, not very fast, and looking all around. He found a door in a wall, but it was locked, and there was no room for a fat little rabbit to squeeze underneath. An old mouse was running in and out over the doorstep, carrying peas and beans to her family in the wood. Peter asked her the way to the gate, but she had such a large pea in her mouth that she could not answer. She only shook her head at him. Peter began to cry. Then he tried to find his way straight across the garden, but he became more and more puzzled. Presently, he came to a pond where Mr. McGregor filled his water cans. A white cat was staring at some goldfish. She sat very, very still, but now and then the tip of her tail twitched as if it were alive. Peter thought it best to go away without speaking to her. He had heard about cats from his cousin, little Benjamin Bunny. He went back towards the tool shed, but suddenly, quite close to him, he heard the noise of a hoe. Scratch, 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 scratch. Peter scuttered underneath the bushes, but presently, as nothing happened, he came out and climbed upon a wheelbarrow and peeped over. The first thing he saw was Mr. McGregor hoeing onions. His back was turned toward Peter, and beyond him was the gate.
Peter got down very quietly off the wheelbarrow and started running as fast as he could go along a straight walk behind some black currant bushes. Mr. McGregor caught sight of him at the corner, but Peter did not care. He slipped underneath the gate and was safe, at last, in the wood outside the garden. Mr. McGregor hung up the little jacket and shoes for a scarecrow to frighten the blackbirds. Peter never stopped running or looked behind him till he got home to the big fir tree. He was so tired that he flopped down upon the nice soft sand on the floor of the rabbit hole and shut his eyes. His mother was busy cooking. She wondered what he had done with his clothes. It was the second little jacket and pair of shoes that Peter had lost in a fortnight. I am sorry to say that Peter was not very well during the evening. His mother put him to bed and made him some chamomile tea, and she gave a dose of it to Peter, one tablespoon to be taken at bedtime. But Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail had bread and milk and blackberries for supper. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony. Liz Pinkham is 11 years old. She is a 7th grader at St. Thomas More Catholic School in San Francisco. Liz came to the Buzz Studios on Good Friday 2017 to read Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree. The Giving Tree was published in 1964 by Harper and Row. She chose this story because it's her principal, Marie Fitzpatrick's favorite book. If you like this story, buy it at a local coastal bookstore. And if you like to read bedtime stories, like Liz does, contact the Buzz Studios and come on down and record.
Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy. And every day the boy would come, and he would gather her leaves, and make them into crowns, and play king of the forest. He would climb up her trunk, and swing from her branches, and eat apples. And they would play hide-and-go-seek, and when he was tired, he would sleep in her shade. And the boy loved the tree very much, and the tree was happy. But time went by, and the boy grew older, and the tree was often alone. Then one day the boy came to the tree, and the tree said, "Come, boy, come climb up my trunk and swing from my branches, and eat apples and play in my shade and be happy." "I am too big to climb and play," said the boy. "I want to buy things and have fun. I want some money. Can you give me some money?" "I'm sorry," said the tree, "but I have no money. I only have leaves and apples. Take my apples, boy, and sell them in the city. Then you will have money, and you will be happy." And so the boy climbed up the tree and gathered her apples and carried them away. And the tree was happy. But the boy stayed away for a long time, and the tree was sad. Then one day the boy came back, and the tree shook with joy. And she said, "Come, boy, come climb up my trunk and swing from my branches and be happy." "I am too busy to climb trees," said the boy. "I want a house to keep me warm," he said. "I want a wife and I want children. And so I need a house. Can you give me a house?"
"I have no house," said the tree. "The forest is my house, but you may cut off my branches and build a house. Then you will be happy." And so the boy cut off her branches and carried them away to build his house. And the tree was happy, but the boy stayed away for a long time. And when he came back, the tree was so happy she could hardly speak. "Come, boy," she whispered, "come and play."
"I am too old and sad to play," said the boy. "I want a boat that will take me far away from here. Can you give me a boat?"
"Cut down my trunk and make a boat," said the tree. "Then you can sail away and be happy." And so the boy cut down her trunk and made a boat and sailed away. And the tree was happy, but not really. And after a long time, the boy came back again. "I am sorry, boy," said the tree, "but I have nothing left to give you. My apples are gone."
"My teeth are too weak for apples," said the boy.
"My branches are gone," said the tree. "You cannot swing on them."
"I am too old to swing on branches," said the boy.
"My trunk is gone," said the tree. "You cannot climb."
"I am too tired to climb," said the boy.
"I am sorry," sighed the tree. "I wish that I could give you something, but I have nothing left. I am just an old stump. I am sorry."
"I don't need very much now," said the boy. just a quiet place to sit and rest. I am very tired.
Well, said the tree, straightening herself up as much as she could. Well, an old stump is good for sitting and resting. Come, boy, sit down. Sit down and rest. And the boy did. And the tree was happy. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Tale of the Flopsy Bunnies by Beatrix Potter, author of The Tale of Peter Rabbit, published by Frederick Warren in New York, copyright 1909. For all little friends of Mr. McGregor and Peter and Benjamin. It is said that the eating of too much lettuce is soporific. I have never felt sleepy after eating lettuces, but then I am not a rabbit. They certainly had a very soporific effect upon the Flopsy bunnies. When Benjamin Bunny grew up, he married his cousin Flopsy. They had a large family, and they were very improvident and cheerful. I do not remember the separate names of their children. They were generally called the Flopsy bunnies. As there was not always quite enough to eat, Benjamin used to borrow cabbages from Flopsy's brother Peter Rabbit, who kept a nursery garden. Sometimes Peter Rabbit had no cabbages to spare. When this happened, the Flopsy bunnies went across the field to a rubbish heap in the ditch outside Mr. McGregor's garden. Mr. McGregor's rubbish heap was a mixture. There were jam pots and paper bags and mountains of chopped grass from the mowing machine, which always tasted oily, and some rotten vegetable marrows and an old boot or two. One day, oh joy, there were a quantity of overgrown lettuces which had shot into flower. The Flopsy bunnies simply stuffed lettuces. By degrees, one after another, they were overcome with slumber and lay down in the mown grass. Benjamin was not as much overcome as his children. Before going to sleep, he was sufficiently wide awake to put a paper bag over his head to keep off the flies. The Flopsy bunnies slept delightfully in the warm sun. From the lawn beyond the garden came the distant clackety sound of the mowing machine. The blue bottles buzzed about the wall, and a little old mouse picked over the rubbish among the jam pots. I can tell you her name. She was called Thomasina Tittlemouse, a wood mouse with a long tail. She rustled across the paper bag and awakened Benjamin Bunny. The mouse apologized profusely and said that she knew Peter Rabbit. While she and Benjamin were talking close under the wall, they heard a heavy tread above their heels, and suddenly Mr. McGregor emptied out a sackful of lawn mowings right upon the top of the sleeping Flopsy bunnies. Benjamin shrank down under the paper bag, and the mouse hid in her jam pot. The little rabbits smiled sweetly in their sleep under the shower of grass. They did not awake because the lettuces had been so soporific. They dreamt that their mother Flopsy was tucking them in to a hay bed. Mr. McGregor looked down after emptying his sack, and he saw some funny little brown tips of ears sticking up through the lawn mowings. He stared at them for some time. Presently, a fly settled on one of them, and it moved. Mr. McGregor climbed down onto the rubbish heap. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 little rabbits, said he as he dropped them into his sack. The Flopsy bunnies dreamt that their mother was turning them over in bed. They stirred a little in their sleep, but still they did not wake up. Mr. McGregor tied up the sack and left it on the wall, and he went to put away the mowing machine. While he was gone, Mrs. Flopsy Bunny, who had remained at home, came across the field. She looked suspiciously at the sack and wondered where everybody was. Then the mouse came out of her jam pot, and Benjamin took the paper bag off his head, and they told her the doleful tale. Benjamin and Flossie were in despair. They could not undo the string. But Mrs. Tittlemouse was a resourceful person. She nibbled a hole in the bottom corner of the sack. The little rabbits were pulled out and pinched to wake them. Their parents stuffed the empty sack with 3 rotten vegetable marrows, an old blacking brush, and 2 decayed turnips. Then they all hid under a bush and watched for Mr. McGregor. Mr. McGregor came back and picked up the sack and carried it off. He carried it hanging down as if it were rather heavy. The Flopsy bunnies followed at a safe distance.
They watched him go into his house, and then they crept up to the window to listen. Mr. McGregor threw down the sack on the stone floor in a way that would have been extremely painful to the Flopsy bunnies if they had happened to have been inside it. They could hear him drag his chair on the flags and chuckle, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 little rabbits, said Mr. McGregor. "Eh, what's that? What have they been spoiling now?" inquired Mrs. McGregor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 little fat rabbits, Mr. McGregor, counting on his fingers. 1, 2, 3. Don't be silly. What do you mean, you silly old man? In the sack. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, replied Mr. McGregor. The youngest Flopsy bunny got upon the window sill. Mrs. McGregor took a hold of the sack and felt it. She said that she could feel 6, but that they must be old rabbits because they were so hard and all different shapes. Not fit to eat, but the skins will do fine to line my old cloak. Line your old cloak, shouted Mr. McGregor. I shall sell them and buy myself baccy. Rabbit tobacco, I shall skin them and cut off their heads. Mrs. McGregor untied the sack and put her hand inside. When she felt the vegetables, she became very, very angry. She said that Mr. McGregor had done it on purpose. And Mr. McGregor was very angry, too. One of the rotten marrows came flying through the kitchen window and hit the youngest Flopsy bunny. It was rather hurt. Then Benjamin and Flopsy thought it was time to go home. So Mr. McGregor did not get his tobacco, and Mrs. McGregor did not get her rabbit skins. But next Christmas, Thomasina Tittlemouse got a present of enough rabbit wool to make herself a cloak and a hood and a handsome muff and a pair of warm mittens. The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
This is Rachel Sage, reading intervention teacher at Farallon View Elementary School, and I am reading Corduroy, written and illustrated by Don Freeman and published by the Viking Press in 1968. Corduroy is a bear who once lived in the toy department of a big store. Day after day he waited with all the other animals and dolls for somebody to come along and take him home. The store was always filled with shoppers buying all sorts of things, but no one ever seemed to want a small bear in green overalls. Then one morning, a girl stopped and looked straight into Corduroy's bright eyes. "Oh, Mommy," she said, "look, there's the very bear I've always wanted." "Not today, dear," her mother sighed. "I've spent too much already. Besides, he doesn't look new. He's lost the button to one of his shoulder straps." Corduroy watched them sadly as they walked away. "I didn't know I'd lost a button," he said to himself. "Tonight I'll go and see if I can find it." Late that evening, when all the shoppers had gone and the doors were shut and locked, Corduroy climbed carefully down from his shelf and began searching everywhere on the floor for his lost button. Suddenly, he felt the floor moving under him. Quite by accident, he had stepped onto an escalator, and up he went. Could this be a mountain, he wondered. I think I've always wanted to climb a mountain. He stepped off the escalator as it reached the next floor, and there, before his eyes, was a most amazing sight. Tables and chairs and lamps and sofas and rows of beds. This must be a palace, Corduroy gasped. I guess I've always wanted to live in a palace. He wandered around, admiring the furniture. This must be a bed, he said. I've always wanted to sleep in a bed. And he crawled onto a large, thick mattress. All at once, he saw something small and round. Why, here's my button, he cried. And he tried to pick it up, but, like all the other buttons on the mattress, it was tied down tight. He yanked and pulled with both paws until, pop, off came the button, and off the mattress Corduroy toppled, bang, into a tall floor lamp. Over it fell with a crash. Corduroy didn't know it, but there was someone else awake in the store. The night watchman was going his rounds on the floor above. When he heard the crash, he came dashing down the escalator. Now who in the world did that? He exclaimed. Somebody must be hiding around here. He flashed his light under and over sofas and beds until he came to the biggest bed of all, and there he saw two fuzzy brown ears sticking up from under the cover. "Hello," he said. "How did you get upstairs?" The watchman tucked Corduroy under his arm and carried him down the escalator and set him on the shelf in the toy department with the other animals and dolls. Corduroy was just waking up when the first customers came into the store in the morning, and there, looking at him with a wide, warm smile, was the same girl he'd seen only the day before. "I'm Lisa," she said, "and you're going to be my very own bear. Last night I counted what I've saved in my piggy bank, and my mother said I could bring you home." "Shall I put him in a box for you?" the sales lady asked. "Oh, no, thank you," Lisa answered, and she carried Corduroy home in her arms. She ran all the way up four flights of stairs into her family's apartment and straight to her own room. Corduroy blinked. There was a chair and a chest of drawers, and alongside a girl-sized bed stood a little bed just the right size for him. The room was small, nothing like that enormous palace in the department store. "This must be home," he said. "I know. I've always wanted a home." Lisa sat down with Corduroy on her lap and began to sew a button on his overalls. "I like you the way you are," she said, "but you'll be more comfortable with your shoulder strap fastened." "You must be a friend," said Corduroy. "I've always wanted a friend." "Me too," said Lisa, and gave him a big hug.
The end.
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.
The Tale of Benjamin Bunny by Beatrix Potter, author of The Tale of Peter Rabbit. Published by Frederick Warren in New York. Copyright 1904. For the Children of Sawri from Old Mr. Bunny. One morning, a little rabbit sat on a bank. He pricked his ears and listened to the trit-trot, trit-trot of a pony. A gig was coming along the road. It was driven by Mr. McGregor, and beside him sat Mrs. McGregor in her best bonnet. As soon as they had passed, little Benjamin Bunny slid down into the road and set off with a hop, skip, and a jump to call upon his relations, who lived in the wood at the back of Mr. McGregor's garden. That wood was full of rabbit holes, and in the neatest, sandiest hole of all lived Benjamin's aunt and his cousins, Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. Old Mrs. Rabbit was a widow. She earned her living by knitting rabbit wool mittens and muffetees. I once bought a pair at a bazaar. She also sold herbs and rosemary tea and rabbit tobacco, which is what we call lavender. Little Benjamin did not very much want to see his aunt. He came round the back of the fir tree and nearly tumbled upon the top of his cousin Peter. He looked poorly and was dressed in a red cotton pocket handkerchief. "Peter," said little Benjamin in a whisper, "who has got your clothes?" "The scarecrow in Mr. McGregor's garden," and described how he'd been chased about the garden and had dropped his shoes and his coat. Little Benjamin sat down beside his cousin and assured him that Mr. McGregor had gone out in a gig, and Mrs. McGregor also, and certainly for the day, because she was wearing her best bonnet. Peter said he hoped that it would rain. At this point, old Mrs. Rabbit's voice was heard inside the rabbit hole calling, "Cottontail! Cottontail! Fetch some more chamomile!" Peter said he thought he might feel better if he went for a walk. They went away hand in hand and got upon the flat top of the wall at the bottom of the wood. From here, they looked down into Mr. McGregor's garden. Peter's coat and shoes were plainly to be seen upon the scarecrow, topped with an old tam-o'-shanter of Mr. McGregor's. Little Benjamin said, "It spoils people's clothes to squeeze under a gate. The proper way to get in is to climb down a pear tree." Peter fell down, head first, but it was of no consequence, as the bed below was newly raked and quite soft. It had been sown with lettuces.
They had left a great many odd-looking footmarks all over the bed, especially since little Benjamin was wearing clogs. Little Benjamin said that the first thing to be done was to get back Peter's clothes in order that they might be able to use the pocket handkerchief. They took them off the scarecrow. There had been rain during that night, there was water in the shoes, and the coat was somewhat shrunk. Benjamin tried on the tam-o'-shanter, but it was too big for him. Then he suggested that they should fill the pocket handkerchief with onions as a little present for his aunt. Peter did not seem to be enjoying himself. He kept hearing noises. Benjamin, on the contrary, was perfectly at home and ate a lettuce leaf. He said that he was in the habit of coming to the garden with his father to get lettuces for their Sunday dinner. The name of little Benjamin's papa was old Mr. Benjamin Bunny. The lettuces certainly were very fine. Peter did not eat anything. He said he should like to go home. Presently, he dropped half the onions. Little Benjamin said that it was not possible to get back up the pear tree with the load of vegetables. He led the way boldly toward the other end of the garden. They went along a little walkway on a plank under a sunny red brick wall. The mice sat on their doorsteps cracking cherry stones and winked at Peter Rabbit and little Benjamin Bunny. Presently, Peter let the pocket handkerchief go again. They got amongst flower pots and frames and tubs. Peter heard noises worse than ever. His eyes were as big as lollipops. He was a step or two in front of his cousin when he suddenly stopped. As they rounded the corner, they saw the cat. Little Benjamin took one look, and then, in half a minute, less than no time, he hid himself and Peter and the onions underneath a large basket. The cat got up and stretched herself and came and sniffed at the basket. Perhaps she liked the smell of onions. Anyway, she sat down upon the top of the basket. She sat there for 5 hours. I cannot draw you a picture of Peter and Benjamin underneath the basket because it was quite dark. And because the smell of onions was fearful, it made Peter Rabbit and little Benjamin cry. The sun got round behind the wood, and it was quite late in the afternoon, but still the cat sat upon the basket. At length, there was a pitter-patter, pitter-patter, and some bits of mortar fell from the wall above. The cat looked up and saw old Mr. Benjamin Bunny prancing along the top of the wall of the upper terrace. He was smoking a pipe of rabbit tobacco and had a little switch in his hand. He was looking for his son. Old Mr. Bunny had no opinion whatever of cats. He took a tremendous jump off the top of the wall onto the top of the cat and cuffed it off the basket and kicked it into the greenhouse, scratching off a handful of fur. The cat was too much surprised to scratch back. When old Mr. Bunny had driven the cat into the greenhouse, he locked the door. Then he came back to the basket and took out his son Benjamin by the ears and whipped him with the little switch. Then he took out his nephew Peter. Then he took out the handkerchief of onions and marched out of the garden. When Mr. McGregor returned about half an hour later, he observed several things which perplexed him. It looked as though some person had been walking all over the garden in a pair of clogs, only the footprints were too ridiculously little. Also, he could not understand how the cat could have managed to shut herself up inside the greenhouse, locking the door handle upon the outside. When Peter got home, his mother forgave him because she was so glad to see that he had found his shoes and coat. Cottontail and Peter folded up the old pocket handkerchief, and old Mrs. Rabbit strung up the onions and hung them from the kitchen ceiling with the bunches of herbs and the rabbit tobacco. The end. Beatrix Potter, born on July 28, 1866, led a sheltered life and spent many years writing and painting for personal pleasure. In 1893, when the young son of a former governess became ill, Beatrix Potter sent him a picture letter all about Peter Rabbit and his adventures in Mr. McGregor's garden.
The letter was a great success, and during the years that followed, many more picture letters were sent, filled with delightful sketches telling the stories that would later develop into Peter Rabbit, Squirrel Nutkin, The Tale of Gloucester, and all the other favorites in the classic collections of the original Peter Rabbit books. Beatrix Potter wrote, "It is much more satisfactory to address a real live child. I often think that that was the secret of the success of Peter Rabbit. It was written to a child, not made to order."
Bedtime Stories is recorded and produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios by Michelle Dragony.